This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. World War II has the greatest generation, Vietnam the hippie generation. But what about the Korean War? Well, perhaps they are the forgotten generation. From 1950 to 1953, more than 35,000 Americans were killed in Korea. Less more than half of the number that was killed in Vietnam, and Vietnam lasted three times longer. The Korean War went badly for the Americans right from the start.
In December 1950, the United Nations forces in Korea had expected total victory. Instead, they were facing total disaster. The huge invasion by the Chinese volunteers had swept across the Yalu into North Korea to check MacArthur's split and ill-organized American advance with extraordinary force and surprise.
The failure to win a decisive victory in Korea is just one of the reasons that war is so little talked about. Melinda Pash documents other reasons in her new book. It's called In the Shadow of the Greatest Generation, The Americans Who Fought the Korean War. She teaches at Fayetteville Technical Community College and joins me in the studio now. Melinda, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So tell us, give us the backstory. How did we get into Korea and the Korean War?
Well, I think you really have to thank Harry Truman for our involvement in Korea. After World War II, we were suddenly faced with what to do with Korea after the Japanese left. Americans were coming in, Russians were coming in, and Truman had to decide, do we just let the Russians have it or do we stake a claim to it? And so really from 1945 on, Korea was split north and south, with the Russians sort of controlling in the north and the Americans in the south. Over time, both superpowers grew a little bit weary of being in Korea, and gradually both withdrew. By that time in the north, you had Kim Il-sung and a communist dictatorship there. In the south, you had Syngman Rhee. I wouldn't call it exactly a democracy, but maybe at least pro-American. And neither side of the Koreas wanted to stay divided. And so ultimately, in June of 1950, Syngman Rhee found himself on the receiving end of the North Korean Inman gun. And that started the war. And once again, Harry Truman had to decide what to do with Korea. Ultimately, he decided he couldn't lose it like he had been accused of losing China. And so he sent in American forces.
And, of course, it was a part of a larger Allied force, but the Americans made up the bulk of that force.
We
that
did
went
indeed,
in.
Yes.
And it didn't go well from the start.
Initially, it did not go well. We were just sort of trying to hold on to any piece of Korea we could. Eventually, the Pusan perimeter is formed, and we started moving out from there. In September, MacArthur came up with a brilliant, if perhaps risky idea that American troops could land at Incheon and sort of cut the communist forces in two. And he was effective at that. He did do that. From that point forward, it looked like an American sweep. And the troops in Korea were talking about going home by Christmas. We were moving up across the 38th parallel into North Korea, decimating North Korean forces. We had defeated the North Korean forces. But unbeknownst to MacArthur, the Chinese had decided they didn't want Americans as border mates. And so they decided to send in maybe a little less than 500,000 troops, volunteers they called them.
Meanwhile, how is the war going at home? What kind of support is there and understanding about this war on the home front?
I think on the home front, it's not so much support for as confusion over. Most people in America had not heard of Korea and really didn't understand why it was necessary to do anything there. And I think that really probably continues on the American home front until very recent years, where people don't understand the importance of the Korean War and looking back at it.
Well, so what was the importance of the war? If you think about it, it's the first hot war in what we came to know as the Cold War. So this is all new for Americans, too, this kind of geostrategic battle over client states in what becomes an imperialist battle between East and West. It's a whole new set of parameters. It's not just one country that needs to be defeated. It's a whole ideology that is fought through client states. Brand new idea.
Yes, brand new idea. And one that maybe Americans are just now coming to terms with.
And in terms of the blueprint, I mean, the generals themselves didn't really have a way of getting their heads around what kind of a war this was. This was a brand new war for them as well, wasn't it?
Well, I think for MacArthur, perhaps it was the same old war. MacArthur's vision, of course, was Americans would accept troops from Taiwan. and that we would keep fighting, and maybe we could, in fact, just take China back. Harry Truman had a different vision, a perhaps more realistic vision. He understood that China in the years since 1949 had changed quite a bit, and that the Chinese army had changed quite a bit. So MacArthur may be the same vision, but when you start looking after MacArthur at General Ridgway and Mark Clark, I think they understand that this is a different kind of war, and it's a war that not every American soldier is going to be involved in. And how do you achieve your objectives, and what should your objectives be?
And was the draft still on at this time?
The draft officially never ended. It was revived by Harry Truman. If you look at the years just prior to Korea, the draft was still in effect, but nobody was really being called up. In fact, in the middle of 1950, we had less than 600,000 U.S. troops in the Army. Truman believed that there would never be another ground war like World War II had been. Everything was going to be fought with nuclear weapons, and the next war was going to be the big one with the Russians. And so there was no need for ground troops.
And that's the other fascinating, one of the many, many fascinating aspects of this. This is the first war in which nuclear weapons are in play from the start. The U.S. had already used the nuclear weapons twice, the only nation
on Earth.
And
Truman had used them.
Truman had used them. So we made the point, and now we're at war. MacArthur wants to use them, and Truman says we can't.
Well, there are some differences. We are not the exclusive possessors of nuclear warfare. By this point, others have exploded their own nuclear weapons. And I think Truman was very cognizant of just what kind of war it could be if the war spread, if it became a war between the U.S. and China or between the U.S. and Russia. And he was very reluctant to go there.
So interestingly enough, this is the first war in modern times where a nation is actually limited from using it the full might of its arsenal. It will not go as far as it can to win the war.
There's a point at which we have to stop, yes.
So this is new as well. What about the ground war? What's it like for the troops on the ground in a place like Korea fighting that war?
The answer to that question really depends on when you look. If you look at the early months of the war, it's a pretty terrible war. It's a war we're not winning. It's a war when entire units are essentially wiped out as we're trying to set up along the Pusan perimeter. For a while, it's tough fighting. After the Incheon landing, it's easy. It's not a bad war at all. We sweep up very handily. American troops are amazed at the speed with which they reach the Yalu River. But then, of course, once the Chinese enter, it's a new thing altogether. Or maybe it's an old thing, because after the Chinese enter, we just don't have I don't know that we don't have enough forces or we choose not to put enough forces, but it becomes trench warfare, very much like World War I. And you have both sides dug in and hoping for some kind of peace with honor, I guess you could say.
Was there any kind of political restriction or hesitation to beef up support, to activate the draft and to get more people involved? Obviously, you would stir the American public and bring attention to the war, and perhaps bring attention to the fact that it's not going so well. Was that a concern?
I don't know if American popular opinion was so much a concern, but I think once the Chinese enter, there is very much an interest to end the war. And there comes to be a realization that, well, maybe we could stop with where we started, that if we could have two Koreas and have South Korea be American, that would be okay. And really, once you see the peace talks begin, first at Kaesong and later at Panmunjom, then you have the idea, we'll put into the war what we need to get what we need out of the peace. And so if the talks were going well, men in the field couldn't necessarily get the brass they needed. You have accounts of Marines picking up their shells, their spent shells, so that they can be used again. And then if the talks are going badly, okay, let's send more in. Let's get troops in and go along the line. So it really depends what time and place you're looking at.
I'm talking today with Melinda Pash, who's the author of In the Shadow of the Greatest Generation, The Americans Who Fought the Korean War. POWs played an important part in that war as well.
They did indeed. In fact, POWs were the stalling point on the peace. It became clear very early in the talks that many of the Chinese and North Koreans who had been taken prisoners of war did not wish to return. Truman was adamant that nobody would be forcibly repatriated. The Chinese were adamant that everybody was going to come home. They could see that this would be embarrassing if scores of soldiers decided not to return. So POWs did play a role there. POWs themselves play a role after the war as well. Something new happens with POWs in Korea that you don't see in any other war, and that is not only are they quite badly treated, if you look at POWs taken hostage by the North Koreans, many of them are simply murdered in cold blood. If you look at POWs after the Chinese enter, it's not just about holding them for what you might get, but rather about re-educating them. And so you see the Chinese setting up indoctrination centers to try and indoctrinate these soldiers who are taken hostage. And so when they come home, Americans aren't sure. Have they been brainwashed? Are these going to be a fifth column?
And you see, because some Americans did stay. I mean, the brainwashing was
they did
effective.
20-some did. I think 25 or 26 Americans did stay. All eventually returned home.
Right.
None of them stayed permanently. But they did stay with the Chinese for a while.
And this was part of what fed the fear that we could have this fifth column then, these returning POWs. We weren't sure about them.
Sure.
And in fact, this generates the Manchurian candidate comes
exactly.
out of this very fear.
Yes.
So how did the government react to that fear that we don't know what to make of these POWs?
Well, that's a tricky subject. If you're looking at how the government, in terms of the military, reacted to it, the Army actually put on trial about 13 men for collaboration. They court-martialed them. As far as the U.S. government, they did put many of these POWs under surveillance and continued to follow them for years after the war.
Was there any truth to their fear? Was it founded? Did anybody have to be court-martialed or taken to court as a result?
If you're asking if people collaborated, it is certain that Americans collaborated. But when you look at the conditions at the camp and the treatment they were given and the torture they were exposed to, the collaboration is entirely understandable. And if you look at the Marine Corps Air Force, who declined to court-martial their own, there was an understanding that statements were signed under duress, that it wasn't the intention of an American soldier to sign statements detrimental to the United States.
But after the fact, in the U.S., they were no threat to security once they were here.
No. I mean, there is some reorganization. There are some more honor codes added in order to try and keep people quiet if they're taken hostage.
So this is the first real combat test of a desegregated military. What role did African Americans play?
African Americans originally start the war in segregated units. What happens as the war goes on, we have manpower problems. And so lots of African Americans end up in white units. It's really, I don't know that you would call it the first integrated war. Maybe you would call it the war that integrated the services. Matthew Ridgway decided once he became commander of the Far East Command that, you know, he needed manpower and he didn't need to be looking over his shoulder and seeing what color people were before assigning them. It's really an issue in the field. People start plugging people in based on military occupational specialty instead of color. It's haphazard. It's taking place before Ridgway takes over and continues after. So you do have lots of African Americans serving in integrated units in Korea. You also have many African Americans staying in the military after the war because, unlike civilian society in the 1950s, they can get a fair shake.
Because the order had gone out. The executive order was issued by Truman in 1948. So
exactly.
Technically, it just hadn't quite happened yet in 50.
Yeah.
Then it happens de facto, and it becomes a better place to stay. You also say that the war was a safer and better place for gay men. It was better to be there than facing discrimination at home.
I think for anybody who's a little bit different in the 1950s, which tend to be an era of conformity in the United States, in the middle of a war zone when people are more interested in whether or not you're going to get their back, they're less interested in what your peculiarities might be.
So it was a better place in some ways. And interestingly enough, the only real rendition we have, the only understanding we have or the popular in popular culture would be MASH.
Yes.
Right? I mean, that's the – what do you make of that? Because in a sense, that was a Vietnam-era sensibility about war that in a way had to be placed in Korea, didn't it? Because we were still too sensitive about Vietnam.
I think that's exactly right. But definitely when you watch MASH, the attitudes and opinions in that show are more Vietnam War. They're definitely not 1950s. And I think for Americans, MASH became the Korean War. In fact, even as a historian, I think my first memories of Korea are of MASH. And I think it became in the popular imagination, this is what Korea was like. But it really wasn't.
So what happened in the immediate aftermath of the war? What happened to those veterans when they returned? What was it about? How did Americans remember in the immediate aftermath?
Well, Well, I think in the immediate aftermath, they didn't. So few Americans, you know, compared to the larger population, served in Korea, unless you happen to be a family member or a friend of one of those 1.8 million who toured the war zone. You didn't really know. You didn't know people had left. You saw them on the street and wondered where they'd been. It wasn't carried. Even during the war kind of finds its way into the back pages of the newspapers. Once Americans found in the war that they weren't going to be subject to rationing, that they weren't going to have to, you know, sacrifice anything from their own lives for this war, they just forget about it. And they didn't notice these veterans coming home. And I think many of these veterans are the same generation as World War II veterans, raised with that, you know, we sacrifice for country and we don't expect something in return. And I think when they didn't get parades and didn't get, you know, all kinds of, foofah over them, they right. came home and went back to work. And it's not really until the 1970s and 1980s, with all of the voices from the Vietnam War, that you begin to see Korean War veterans starting to take a hold again of their veteran status.
What about the medical care and psychiatric care that they would have needed coming home?
There's very little. In fact, some of the guys that came back from Korea had vivax malaria, which lays dormant for years, and then it would crop out. And the VA wasn't equipped to deal with that because they shouldn't have had it, right? They're out of the service by then. So there's a question of whether they can even be treated. Psychiatric care was non-existent. In fact, many of the veterans that I interviewed for the book talked about how they struggled for years with what later is identified as PTSD or alcoholism or whatever brought on by the war. But again, it wasn't until they went to the VA for other things and saw signs up for group meetings with Vietnam War veterans that they began to think, wait a minute, this might be what I have. And it's only in response to that, Korean War veterans who showed up at these meetings, that the VA then sent out surveys trying to locate Korean War veterans who might have had issues left from the war.
This is the forgotten war in many ways, one that we don't talk much about. What got you interested in it?
Well, like most people, I wasn't very interested at first. When I went to graduate school, I thought I wanted to write on the Vietnam War. You know, I'm a Full Metal Jacket generation, and I started going to all kinds of veterans things, veterans balls, powwows. I was living in Oklahoma where the honor guards were Vietnam veterans. And at one of these veterans proms, I fell in with a group of veterans, and I thought, aha, these are the sources for my epic book on Vietnam War veterans. And as I sat there, I realized these guys don't know anything about Vietnam because I've read about it and what they're saying has nothing to do with Vietnam. And then I realized they were talking about Korea. But even me as a historian, I had to really think about it. And I went home that night and started looking up the Korean War and realized nobody ever talked about Korean War or Korean War veterans. And the more I read, the more interested I became and really came to see in light of what North Korea has become that the Korean War was a very significant war for America and for the world today.
It became a blueprint. What is the lesson of Korea today as you look at Iraq, Afghanistan now? What do you think are the lessons that we could draw?
Sometimes small, seemingly insignificant places can be very significant, and you have to keep your eyes open that if we let Korea go, think what North Korea would be to us now.
And the question about sacrifice and America's understanding and sense of the war when it doesn't have to, most Americans aren't making the sacrifice that few Americans are, that seemed to be a kind of a significant point as well.
Yeah, definitely. We need to keep in mind. And, you know, I have many of these Afghanistan and Iraq warriors in my classes. Mm-hmm. And I do think, you know, we need to remember them.
Thank you so much. Great talking with you. Wonderful book, Melinda.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Melinda Pash is the author of In the Shadow of the Greatest Generation, The Americans Who Fought the Korean War. She teaches at Fayetteville Technical Community College. Just ahead, how bloggers have taken over the frontier of science reporting. Stay with us on The State of Things.